debate.
Russia accuses Britain and the United States of trying to incite conflict in the Black Sea by refusing to accept that Crimea is part of Russia. Tensions run high following the presence of a British destroyer off the coast of the Crimean Peninsula. On Wednesday, the UK said their ship was conducting innocent passage through Ukrainian territorial waters. Russia says its forces fired warning shots and dropped bombs to deter the British ship, accusing it of entering Russia's territorial waters. Both sides accuse each other of producing inaccurate accounts of the standoff. Russia's Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov said that Moscow will defend its borders by all means, warning Britain that in the future bombs would be sent not only in its path but also on target if there were any further provocative actions. Joining us on today, we have our correspondent Amina Taylor, who's joining us from the British capital, London. Amina, please bring us up to speed where these tensions could be heading.
Well, unfortunately, Bardia, it's never a good sign when an escalation of this magnitude concerns as many countries as it does, because we're not just talking about whatever a country's particular position is on the 2014 standoff between Ukraine and, of course, the Russian Federation here. Britain conducted what they're saying was an innocent naval exercise in disputed waters. So it didn't even really matter, actually, if they believed that those waters were the territorial property of the Russian Federation or not. The fact that you would stir the pot, as it will, by having HMS Defender come through that territory at such diplomatically sensitive times. There are, of course, naval exercises, Operation Sea Breeze, taking place in the Black Sea nearby, which Russia has called on the United States and its allies to cancel. And for Britain to do this act at this time is sending one very clear message. It is an escalation in events, and it doesn't matter what the Prime Minister and the Ministry of Defense say about disputing the sequence of events or disputing whether or not bombs were dropped and shots were fired. The fact is, in such sensitive areas, in such a sensitive situation, to have your naval vessel, your armed naval vessel, go all that way from British waters to essentially stir up a hornet's nest is not really sending a message of diplomacy and a message of wanting to take this as a matter between the Russians and the Ukrainians. The United Kingdom and the United States have clearly chosen sides here, and depending on who blinks next, this could be a serious, very serious issue. Let's not be candid about it, but let's not mince our words here. International global conflicts have started for less.
All right, thanks a lot. Amina Taylor joining us from the British capital, London. We're bringing in now author and historian Marcus Papadopoulos, who's with us also from the British capital. Mr. Papadopoulos, welcome to the program. Talk to us about where this incident happened and whether Russia's response was justified, in your opinion.
Well, the staged provocation orchestrated by Britain and America, in which a Royal Navy vessel, specifically HMS Defender, illegally entered Russian maritime waters adjacent to the Crimea, was a foolhardy and, worse still, an exceedingly dangerous act which could have provoked a military conflict between the West and Russia. And I say that America was also involved in this staged provocation because London and Washington work in unison on the international stage, especially when it comes to Russia. So the question we have to address is this: why did London and Washington stage a provocation in Russian maritime waters? I do not believe that the West seriously intends to provoke a conflict with the Russian Federation, because a conflict with the Russian Federation would start with a military conflict and would rapidly escalate into a nuclear conflict in which mankind would, simply put, be wiped out. So, I believe that the intended objective of the British-American staged provocation was to add momentum to building up the case for, firstly, NATO's increasing presence on the western border of the Russian Federation, and secondly, for Ukraine to be admitted to NATO. The official argument of the British government that British naval vessels are perfectly entitled to enter the waters around the Crimea, because London does not recognise the Crimea as part of Russia, instead it recognises the Crimea as part of Ukraine, is untenable. Why? Firstly, even though London never recognised the Baltic states of Estonia, Latvia and Lithuania as part of the Soviet Union, nonetheless, the British government never deployed Royal Naval vessels to Soviet maritime waters off the coast of the Baltic states. And secondly, if the logic of the British government is to be extended across the world, then other nations in the world should not accept or respect British jurisdiction over the north of Ireland or Northern Ireland, or British jurisdiction over the Falkland Islands or the Malvinas, or indeed British jurisdiction over the Chagos Islands. So quite frankly, the British-American staged provocation was part and parcel of a campaign to build up the case for Ukraine to be admitted to NATO, to portray Russia in an exceedingly negative way in which the Russians are projected as aggressive and dangerous, and thirdly, to justify the increase in NATO's budget and thereby defend the ongoing increases in NATO soldiery and weaponry along the Russian border in Eastern Europe, from the Baltic Sea to the Black Sea.
Okay, Mr. Papadopoulos, you've pretty much said it all. That almost wraps up the debate for us. Let's cross over now to editor of Veterans Today, Mr. Mike Harris, who's joining us from Phoenix. Mr. Harris, welcome to the program. I'm sure you were listening to what Mr. Papadopoulos was saying in London. Give us your viewpoint on this. Was this a provocation by the British Royal Navy, or was it what they were saying themselves, a legitimate exercising of the right of passage at sea?
So it absolutely was a provocation by the British Navy. And in fact, on Veterans Today, we published today the tape that the FSB released from the bridge of the Russian warship that fired the three rounds across the bow of the British destroyer. So that is up. It's there. The British destroyer was warned both in English and in Russian multiple times, and they ignored their warnings and proceeded ahead. And after multiple warnings, then the Russian ship did fire warning shots across the bow to back the British off. So they were duly warned verbally multiple times, and they proceeded anyway. So this was a British provocation. Now you have to remember that the U.S. has been meddling in Ukrainian affairs since 2004. I was there in 2004 during the Orange Revolution. And I have been to Crimea. I've been to the Russian naval base in Sevastopol. And Russia is not going to give that asset up. They have an agreement with the Ukrainian government to keep functioning. And if you remember correctly, after Victoria Nuland and the U.S. CIA and other intelligence agencies toppled the Yanukovych government, the Crimean people voted overwhelmingly via referendum to join the Russian Federation. And so they seceded from Russia, and they went back to being, seceded from Ukraine, and went back to being a Russian state, which is where they were before Nikita Khrushchev ceded Crimea to Ukraine back in 1959, 1960, I forget the exact date. But historically, Crimea has been a Russian asset. And historically, most of Ukraine has been a Russian asset. If you go back historically, the capital of Ukraine, Kiev, used to be the capital of the Russian Empire. So people need to keep this in mind, that these are primarily Russian people, Slavic people from Russia, Russian speaking, and the U.S. is over there meddling and interfering, and the British are helping.
Right. Mr. Papadopoulos, let's go over some of the details of the timeline. The British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, on Thursday, he said that it was entirely right for their warship to travel through the waters off Crimea, and it was acting in accordance with international law. Now, this is all going on as there's amid a diplomatic spat between Russia and London. When tensions were high between Kiev and Moscow back in 2018, the UK also sent a Royal Navy ship to the Black Sea port of Odessa in a show of support for Ukraine. This, of course, happened in 2018, so this is not without precedent, is it?
The root cause of tension between the West and Russia revolves around NATO expansion into Eastern Europe and also into the Baltic states, which formerly were a part of the USSR. Now, the Americans have been coveting Ukraine ever since Ukraine became an independent state in December of 1991. Why is Ukraine so important to Washington? Namely, if America is successful in its ambition to admit Ukraine into the ranks of NATO, then America will be the dominant naval power in the Black Sea. Russian influence and power in Europe would be severely curtailed, and thereby Russian influence and power in the world in general would be severely curtailed. The British government cites international law as the basis for why HMS Defender entered the waters around the Crimea. But quite frankly speaking, the British government doesn't have a leg to stand on, so to speak, because the Ukrainian constitution was severely violated in February of 2014 when a democratically elected president who was recognized by both America and the European Union and also Britain was overthrown in a Western orchestrated coup. Therefore, the Ukrainian constitution was in February 2014 dead, so to speak. And as a result of the coup, which brought to power authorities which had no legitimacy whatsoever, the people of the Crimea, who are overwhelmingly Russian, and those people who identify as Ukrainian but nonetheless regard Russia as their mother country, came together to resist what had happened in Kiev and to seize the opportunity to break away from Kiev and to reunite with Russia. And that was the will of the people of the Crimea. As I said moments ago, if the British are going to apply the argument that their Royal Navy vessels can enter the waters of the Crimea because they do not recognize the Crimea as part of Russia, then quite frankly, the Russian Navy can enter the waters of the North or
sure.
Northern Island, because Moscow could take the line that it doesn't recognize British jurisdiction over the North of Ireland or Northern Ireland.
Let's go back to Mr. Harrison Phoenix. This is an issue that Mr. Papadopoulos has brought up on two occasions. Now, how does, in your opinion, all of this, the Black Sea incident, the Western troop buildup in Ukraine, in addition to NATO's eastward expansion, how does this all play into the rivalry between Russia and NATO? As we know, Russia has already made it clear that NATO membership for Ukraine would be a red line for Moscow.
Well, you have to remember, after the Berlin Wall came down, that the U.S. entered an agreement with the Russian Federation that NATO would not expand eastward. And they have violated that agreement spirit and in implementation, because they have expanded greatly to the east. This was not what the Russian Federation signed on for, and the U.S. And NATO is in direct violation of that accord. So that is one point. You know, like I said, historically, Ukraine has been allied with Russia, and in fact, at one time, Kiev was the capital of the Russian Empire. The people there are essentially, you know, by genetic descent, are Russians. They are the Slavic people. And to try to peel that off of their close bond would be like the U.S. peeling away from Canada. And another analogy I'd like to make is can you imagine if the Russians or the Chinese would send warships into the Gulf of Mexico? The U.S. would be coming unglued, and they would use any means possible to expel them from that American lake down there we call the Gulf of Mexico. That is exactly the position that the U.S. has put Russia in by needing to expel these foreign interlopers that have no claim and no business being in the Black Sea at all. The Black Sea is a Russian lake, and it has been, and it will continue to be, unless the U.S. and the Western forces of NATO wish to go to full-scale war with Russia, because they will defend their territory. And the U.S. has been aching for an engagement with Russia for some time. This is very, very unwise, and I really caution against it. And I really hope that the powers that be in the U.S. within our government come to their senses and back off of this, because this is extremely dangerous. As Mr. Papadopoulos has said, this could lead to a nuclear confrontation, whether it's at the tactical level or on the strategic level. In any case, it will be a disaster for the area and for all the people of the planet.
Mr. Papadopoulos, one detail that we skipped here was the war of words between Moscow and London, which escalated on Thursday. Both sides accused one another of giving inaccurate accounts of the incident. Moscow's version of events goes as such that a Russian aircraft bombed the path of the British destroyer. London dismisses Moscow's version of events as, quote-unquote, predictably inaccurate. What do you see with these two different and somewhat contradicting accounts?
Well, they certainly are contradictory accounts. However, the Russian version of events has been corroborated by the Kremlin. There is footage of the standoff between a Russian tactical fighter aircraft and HMS Defender, but also we have insiders from the British Ministry of Defence and also from British journalists who were on board HMS Defender at the time, who have also confirmed that the Russian version of events is the accurate version and that 10 Downing Street is not telling the truth. But let me add this. There will be no further NATO expansion into Eastern Europe. There may be NATO expansion into Southeastern Europe, specifically Serbia and Bosnia, but as regards NATO expansion into Eastern Europe, that has come to an end, because the Kremlin will use all means at its disposal, and I mean all means at its disposal, to ensure that Ukraine never enters NATO, because a Ukraine in NATO would mean that Russian national security would be seriously compromised. Russia would no longer be the dominant naval power in the Black Sea. NATO tactical aircraft operating from Ukrainian territory could enter the skies above Moscow in 12 to 15 minutes. So there will be no further NATO expansion into Eastern Europe. And secondly, I would say this to Whitehall, to the British government. Instead of attempting to goad Russia by deploying Royal Naval vessels into Russian maritime waters, Whitehall should instead ensure that the Royal Navy is protecting the English Channel from illegal immigrants who are crossing on a daily basis from France into England, specifically Dover, because British taxpayers' money is being misused. British sailors are being, the lives of British sailors are being put in danger in the Black Sea. British sailors should be in the English Channel defending taking Dover from illegal immigration from Calais. I think the British taxpayer, if they knew the full story, if Britain had a free and independent media, would be livid at the knowledge that the Royal Navy, instead of defending the English Channel, is deployed to the Black Sea and is potentially risking a military and nuclear confrontation with Russia, which, as I said at the beginning of this program, would, if it came about,
right,
signal the end of mankind.
Let's get one last question in from Mr. Harrison Phoenix, Russia. As you mentioned, annexed the Crimean Peninsula following a referendum back in 2014. So obviously considers areas around its coast to be Russian waters. Sergei Ryabkov said that Washington and London are sowing strife by refusing to accept Crimea as part of Russia. There is clear hypocrisy here again by the likes of the U.S. Mr. Papadopoulos mentioned a few instances, for example, the Malvinas, which are being have been annexed or, in other words, occupied by the British for years. There is another example also when the Israelis, they want to annex the Golan Heights, the United States accepts it. When they want to annex parts of the West Bank, the occupied West Bank, the United States will accept that. So they can accept illegal annexations and occupation by their allies, like the Israelis, but when it's not in their own interest, they'll oppose it.
Well, that's entirely accurate. And I need to agree with Mr. Papadopoulos again, because the U.S. has the same problem with our southern border. We should not be deploying troops around the world. We should be defending our own border and using our military resources to expel the invaders who are pouring into our country the same way that British soldiers, British sailors should be defending the British coast from the invasion of Calais. We've got the exact same problem here. It appears the Western governments are more driven to expand their empire and expand their grasp of control of the world's resources than they are in defending their own countries. And this is a mistake. This is not why people join our military. They join our military because they love our country, they want to defend it and defend it, but yet they're not defending our own borders. They're wide open. We have immigrants pouring in from everywhere in the world. And this is just another symptom of the sickness that is going on within the United States government.
Okay.
Our government is ill. We need systemic reform here in the U.S., and we need to get a foreign policy that works for the American people, not for this expansion of Western empire.
Very well. Thank you, gentlemen. Author and historian Marcus Papadopoulos joining us from the British capital, London. Also thanks to editor of Veterans Today, Mike Harris, joining us from Phoenix, Arizona. And also special thanks to you for joining us. For staying with us on this debate, it's good night for now.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarisi, and we're with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll be discussing the commentary of the 23rd chapter of the Holy Quran, Surah Al-Mu'minun, or the Believers. Now let's just listen to the related verses, and then we'll be back. So stay with us.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
الصيحة بالحق فجعلناهم غثاء فبعدا للقوم الظالمين.
So the shriek seized them in truth, and we made them as plant stubble. Then away with the wrongdoing people.
Dear listeners, brothers and sisters, as you have been previously with us, we were talking about the 41st verse of chapter Mu'minun. فَأَخَذَتْهُمُ الصَّيْحَةُ بِالْحَقِّ فَجَعَلْنَاهُمْ غُثَاءً فَبُعْدًا لِلْقَوْمِ الظَّالِمِينَ. Then the blast overtook them with justice, and we made them into a scum, so away with the unjust people. Some of you listeners are completely now familiarized with the story of people of Thamud, their prophet, the sign of prophethood, the miracle that was the camel that came out of the middle of the mountain. Those people killed that sign of their Lord, and they denied the prophethood. They said that he is not a prophet, he is forging a lie about Allah, and we will not believe in him. They also did not believe in resurrection, and they reasoned that there is nothing but this world. We live, we die in this one, and we will not be raised again. But in response to that, Prophet Salih invoked to his Lord, and the Almighty Allah sent a blast, and that blast overtook them, and they were made into a scum, as this verse says. فَجَعَلْنَاهُمْ غُثَاءً فَبُعْدًا لِلْقَوْمِ الظَّالِمِينَ. So away with the unjust people. But since the very verse begins with this phrase, فَأَخَذَتْهُمُ الصَّيْحَةُ, the blast overtook them, let's talk about the meaning of صَيْحَة a little bit. The Arabic word صَيْحَة here, or the cry, philologically means a very loud noise coming out of the mouth of animal or a human being. This noise, however, is not particular to these two kinds and can be applied to a very loud noise, be it created from a human or animal or any other thing. We read in the Holy Quran that some sinful nations were destroyed by Sayha. A few of them are the nations of Thamud, Lut, and Shu'aib. Also, it is understood from the other verses of the Holy Quran that the punishment of people of Thamud was carried by a thunderbolt. For example, the Holy Quran says, فَإِنْ أَعْرَضُوا فَقُلْ أَنذَرْتُكُمْ صَاعِقَةً مِثْلَ صَاعِقَةِ عَادٍ وَثَمُودٍ. The 13th verse of chapter Fussilat says, but if they turn away, men say, I have warned you of a thunderbolt, like the thunderbolt of Ad and Thamud. So this verse, dear listeners, shows that the meaning of Sayha is the terrible sound of a thunderbolt.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
we
approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly, the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran. By Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
Now, the question is, can the terrifying noise of a thunderbolt kill a crowd of people like the people of Ad and Thamud? The answer to this question is surely positive, because we know that if sound waves exceed a certain limit, they can break building glasses, they can even destroy some buildings and disable some organs of the human body. When an airplane breaks the sound barrier, some people fall unconscious, and sometimes it happens that that very sound breaks all the glasses in the buildings of the locality. So it is natural that if the intensity of acoustic waves increase to a certain level, it can easily cause deadly disorders in the nervous system, in the brain vessels, and in the heart, so it can definitely kill some people. Of course, according to the Holy Quran, the end of this world would be with such a cry. The Holy Quran says, مَا يَنُظُرُونَ إِلَّا صَيْحَةً وَاحِدَةً تَأْخُذُهُمْ وَهُمْ يَخِصِّمُونَ. In chapter Yasin, the 49th verse says, مَا يَنْظُرُونَ إِلَّا سَيْحَةً وَاحِدَةً. They await nothing but a single cry. تَأْخُذُهُمْ وَهُمْ يَخِصِّمُونَ. It will overtake them while they are disputing. So it is similar to resurrection, which begins with an awakening blast. It is also said in another verse in the Holy Quran, there would be naught but a single cry. Then behold, they shall all be brought before us. So we have seen some small instances of being killed or being shaken by the blast, or sayha as this verse, and it is definitely possible that some people are killed with the threatening sound of a blast. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
World with reporters. Shocking footage filmed on the 18th of June, Iran's election day, shows Iranian expats being attacked outside polling stations up and down the UK. Victims included women and the elderly, the perpetrators, supporters of anti-Iran terrorist groups, including the MEK, communists, and Shah royalists.
Videos released on social media show fanatic protesters hurling Islamophobic abuse and even physically assaulting voters in cities including Birmingham, Manchester, and here in London too.
One victim reached out to tell us about her ordeal.
As soon as I got near the embassy, I was wearing the hijab, obviously, and the crowd started roaring and screaming, and they got louder. As they saw me, obviously, going to vote, calling me names, calling my family names, cursing my mother, my father. I heard a rock hit the ground. I didn't look back because I was shaking at that time as well. One of them said to me, and funnily enough, the policeman was there, but obviously, he couldn't understand Parsi. He's telling me if I had a knife, I would cut you in pieces right here, right now. I was so shaking. Yeah. Since then, I've suffered with anxiety since that day. I said to myself, I should have left. But I stood my ground. I said, why should I leave? And the people coming, I said, why are you calling me names? They said, we call you names because you deserve it.
Britain boasts about being a defender of democracy on the world stage. But these violent scenes suggest that the UK failed miserably to protect democratic rights of Iranians inside its own borders. Despite these attempts, Iran's election went ahead, with President-elect Sayed Ibrahim Raisi coming out on top. Robert Carter, London.
It's the world's second most populous nation, and the figures of COVID-19 infection cases are rising on a daily basis. The cities are bustling as the country is picking up pace as the world's fastest growing major economies. But in all this hustle bustle and race of survival, an important aspect of life is on stake, and that is mental health. The second wave of COVID-19 has altered the lifestyle of millions across India who now are struggling in silence. Reports suggest more than 70% of those in the age group of 18 to 24 are suffering from some form of depression. Now, the COVID-19 pandemic has ignited the crisis further, as many are facing financial and social hardships. According to psychological experts, economic and social pressures combined with the lack of appropriate mental health facilities is a major reason behind this new epidemic, which has now started exploding due to the coronavirus pandemic. Based on reports, the economic cost of mental illness in India is expected to be more than $1 trillion by 2030.
COVID-19 has impacted a lot. A lot means, you can say, almost everyone, because one or the other way, everyone has been affected, whether it's, the infection has caused or the mental health or the other ways, because the businesses has shut down.
Health experts say all disorders are linked to a fast-paced lifestyle, stress, complexities of living, breakdown of support systems, and challenges of economic instability. They say the COVID pandemic has added fuel to the fire with depression, anxiety disorders, schizophrenia, psychotic disorders, and substance abuse being common in most people.
One must go for yoga daily. Yoga, you have to do proper yoga. Then breathing exercises are there. They have to do at least half an hour to 1 hour so that the blood circulation towards brain increases.
COVID-19 lockdowns impacted people from all walks of life and age groups. Now they're finding it hard to deal with consequences of the pandemic-induced lockdowns. Many turn to drugs and alcohol, while others prefer religious therapies and yoga. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Britain's travel industry is frustrated and nervous. Protesting around the country on June 23rd, people whose jobs rely on international travel, now only working at 10% capacity. They want more countries on the so-called green list to save jobs.
It just doesn't make a lot of sense. And then why put some on the green list and then take them off? Like, say we booked a holiday to Portugal. We were supposed to be there this week and we've cancelled it because it went amber and it was going to cost another £1,000 in COVID tests.
The restrictions are now crazy. So I'm stuck in England for quite a long time. And I wish to travel back to my country as I haven't seen my mom for 2 years.
Green means arrivals to the UK do not need to self-isolate, but have to take a test before and after they travel. Amber means self-isolating at home for up to 10 days, and red means quarantining at a hotel paid for by the travelers.
In the past few days, some government officials suggested double-jabbed passengers from amber-list countries could be exempt from quarantining.
We're also looking to see how we can replace the protections that are currently there with the restrictions with protections that come from the vaccine with respect to international travel as well, but it is more difficult freeing up international travel.
And difficult it will be when it comes to the willingness of other countries to let British tourists in. Germany has called on all EU countries to make British travelers quarantine on arrival to slow the spread of the Delta variant. All this as the UK recorded more than 16,000 new COVID cases Wednesday, the highest figure since early February, most of them caused by the Delta variant first discovered in India. There were also 19 deaths. The travel industry is yet to react to the government announcement, but with countries moving up and down the UK government's list, British travelers have to think again before they take a gamble. Saeed Puriza, London.
As anti-Westminster sentiment continues to rise, another part of Britain is entering the fight to break away from the UK. Cornwall, located on the southwest of the island, is witnessing the start of a new pro-independence advocacy group which aims to revive a lesser-known campaign for Cornish independence.
All under one banner's Curnow is the latest branch in a wider organisation which already has roots in Scotland and Wales. In both countries, All Under One Banner has achieved significant success in opening up the debate on independence. Locals in Cornwall are hoping to achieve the same.
Many Cornish people who are recognised as a Celtic minority have various grievances with the English-centric London rule, including a lack of funding and a systematic destruction of an ancient culture.
That's a good way of explaining it. We're a long colonised place, possibly longer than the Welsh, who also probably feel that they've been colonised as well. But we've recovered that history, and that's one of our greatest successes. And the greatest challenge now is decolonising the history and explaining it to Anglo-Saxon ears.
In past campaigns, activists have been branded as nationalists who hate the English, a claim rejected by locals.
Got no problem with the English or with any other nationality at all. What I have a problem with is the way that possibly we are represented through them, and the way sometimes we are talked down to and treated by them. But no, there's no problem at all. We have so many friends from all over the world down here.
For now, Cornish independence is a minority view, but lifelong campaigners believe things are changing.
I think we're already getting there in terms of greater autonomy, understanding the need for it. The next question is how to get it, and obviously there are political ways of getting it, but there's also a need for people to go out and campaign for it.
The idea of Scotland or Wales breaking away has sent shivers down Number 10. This latest development in Cornwall will surely only worsen Downing Street's fears. Robert Carter, London.
The US Justice Department committed a new flagrant violation of the freedom of the press and blocked several regional outlets' websites, including the Yemeni channel Al Masira and Iran's Press TV, claiming they are linked to what it calls Iranian disinformation efforts. Yemenis condemned this move, saying it proves that the US called for freedom of speech are lies.
The seizure of some of the websites affiliated with the resistance front comes amid the media war. The Saudi-led coalition has been trying since the beginning of its war on Yemen to cover up its crimes committed against Yemenis and to mislead world public opinion.
Yemen's Ministry of Information said the U.S. government seizure of a few websites confirmed the strength of the media of the resistance and proved that these websites revealed the true face of the U.S., including its participation in the brutal Saudi war on Yemen.
We condemn the seizure of some websites affiliated with the resistance front. This move shows that these websites have been strong enough to influence the American public opinion by releasing the realities on the ground. It reveals the falsehood of American claims about democracy and freedom of speech. Certainly, there are solutions to this blocking, and the websites will be running again.
Ali Ashrai, the manager of Al Masira website, said this move revealed the weakness of the U.S., even though it owns thousands of media outlets.
This step reveals the great weakness that the United States is suffering from, even though it owns thousands of websites, satellite channels, newspapers, and radio stations. However, it was unable to withstand a few channels with limited capabilities which convey the truth as it is and express the opinion of the free people in this world.
Experts believe that this step is part of a media war of the U.S. government against the media outlets of the resistance. They said these attacks will persist and the resistance access should be ready for further violations.
Yemenis say the freedom of speech is a fundamental right for all free people of the world, and the United States has no right to deny individuals or communities this right. They believe that such attacks will promote the free media outlets to continue exposing the U.S. policies. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
A number of Palestinian prisoners are going on with an open-ended hunger strike to protest their illegal imprisonment without charge or trial under Israel's so-called administrative detention. At least three prisoners insist to continue their strike despite their seriously deteriorating condition until Israel releases them. Among them is 28-year-old Ghadanfar Abu Atwan, who has started his hunger strike almost 50 days ago. After starting his strike, Israel's prison authorities placed him in isolation. Later, he was transferred to Kaplan Medical Center south of Tel Aviv because of his serious illness, and he's being held there under detention.
Of course, when all doors are shut down in the face of the prisoners to get rid of the administrative detention, they have few means to protest and they have to engage in the hunger strike battle, especially that many prisoners' terms are renewed for several times and this without charge or trial. When Ghadanfar started his protest, he was beaten and tortured by the Israeli jailers and he was held in solitary confinement.
Palestinians held a protest in solidarity with the prisoners outside the Red Cross Committee building in Ramallah. The oldest of those taking part is 59-year-old, a senior leader of the Hamas movement, Jamal Tawil, joined in protest over the detention of his daughter, journalist Bushra Tawil. He's demanding Israeli authorities to release him and his daughter. Israeli court had extended Bushra's previous administrative detention order last March. There is also Sheikh Khadr Adnan, prominent leader of the jihad movement, whom is staging his fifth hunger strike. This is the 12th time he has been detained.
To
Today, we are here not only to stand by the prisoners and support them. This is the least we can do against the administrative detention policy. Israel arrests people from all walks of life and different political spectrum. We are in real need to launch a national and worldwide campaign to force Israel to stop this policy that exposes the Israeli authorities and their illegal practices.
The Palestinian Prisoners Society said the Israeli authorities have lately increased the use of administrative detention against Palestinians. The committee said Israeli authorities issued 200 administrative detention orders since the beginning of May. The majority of the hunger-striking prisoners are those who are held arbitrarily under Israel's policy of administrative detention. That's why they put their lives on the line to demand not only their freedom, but an end to the administrative detention policy. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
The U.S. Special Envoy for North Korea visited South Korea for talks with both his South Korean and Japanese counterparts. Sung Kim then repeated Washington's desire for dialogue with Pyongyang.
Most importantly, we reaffirmed our two countries' shared commitment to pursuing the complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula through diplomacy and dialogue. We took note of the recent statement out of Pyongyang regarding the preparation for dialogue, and we hope to receive a positive response to our proposal for a meeting soon.
U.S. President Joe Biden's new point man on North Korea, however, conditioned any negotiations on U.S.-led sanctions against North Korea remaining in place, which many see as a barrier to kickstarting broader denuclearization talks. Some activists suggest the tension provides the U.S. an excuse to deploy troops to the region and support American weapons producers.
The importance of the Korean Peninsula has increased as the U.S. military pressure and response to China has been strengthened. The traditional diplomatic and security establishment of the U.S. wants to maintain a certain level of conflict on the Korean Peninsula.
North Korean leader Kim Jong-un last week told officials at a party meeting to be prepared for both dialogue and confrontation. Pyongyang later responded to Washington's offer of talks with ridicule, suggesting a wrong interpretation would lead to disappointment. The U.S. may be paying more attention to North Korea with the appointment of a special envoy in his five-day visit here to South Korea. The question is whether that will translate into greater flexibility from Washington in terms of offering Pyongyang some sanctions relief as North Korea deals with the COVID-19 pandemic and recent natural disasters. Frank Smith, Seoul.
In less than 2 months, Iran's president-elect Ebrahim Raisi will take over power. And speculations over the fate of the 2015 nuclear deal is now the talk of the town, while there are still major sticking points in the Vienna talks over the revival of the accord. Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif said the discussions are likely to reach a conclusion before the end of President Hassan Rouhani's term in mid-August.
There is a good possibility that we will reach an agreement before the end of our tenure.
In his weekly briefing, the Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman said the U.S. is slowing down the process.
Iran and the U.S. still have differences over some of the issues. What's ahead is for the U.S. to make a political decision and lift the sanctions.
Reports coming out of Vienna suggest that the excessive demands of the U.S. and European parties to the deal are to blame for the sluggish talks. The U.S. wants the destruction of Iran's new generation centrifuges in exchange for only a temporary suspension of some of the anti-Iran sanctions, a demand beyond Iran's commitments under the accord. In his first presser as president-elect, Raisi made it clear that the U.S. must lift all sanctions before Tehran returns to its full compliance to the atomic accord. He said he will not allow the talks to become erosive.
The Americans violated the JCPOA and the Europeans did not comply with their commitments. The U.S. was obliged to remove all sanctions under the JCPOA, but it has failed to do so. The Americans should return and fulfill their commitments. I tell the Europeans not to be impacted by the pressure and the foreign policy of the Americans and to fulfill their obligations under the JCPOA.
Officially known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA, The nuclear deal has been in limbo for 3 years, since the former U.S. administration discarded the accord in 2018 and reinstated sanctions on Iran. In a tit-for-tat, Tehran adopted a stepwise suspension of its own nuclear commitments. The last remedial step involved ramping up the purity level of enriched uranium to 60%, way above the 3.67% cap set by the deal.
The Iranian Foreign Ministry hopes the Vienna talks will conclude before Rouhani's term is over. Observers say this scenario is the best for the U.S., and any foot-dragging means the talks will have to continue with the new Iranian administration, which maintains a tougher tone toward the U.S. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Iran's AB Helm and several lawyers have filed a complaint against Mölnlycke Healthcare, a Swedish medical device company, over its refusal to sell medical products to Tehran under U.S. pressures. Mölnlycke Healthcare refused to sell Iranian AB patients medical care items they needed, including Mepilex dressings. Several children in Iran who suffered from epidermolysis bullosa lost their lives due to the lack of urgently needed medical equipment, and some others were hurt by severe physical injuries, including amputation. Many human rights groups have criticized the U.S. for cutting off banking ties with Iran through threatening the international banks with punitive fines by the U.S. Department of Treasury, which has resulted in cutting Iranian patients' access to necessary medical items.
Since May 2018, that the U.S. unilaterally withdrew from the JCPOA, up to May 2019, a number of children suffering from EB died only because they did not have Mepilex dressings. I want to tell those who claim to be defenders of human rights what has been the crime of this 37-day-old baby who died of the disease only because we did not have Mepilex dressings as a result of the U.S. sanctions.
The move has deprived EB patients, also known as butterfly patients, of essential medical items, killed many of them, especially children, and inflicted serious physical injuries, such as amputation, to some of the patients. The complaint seeks to protect the victims of the open violation of human rights committed by the Swedish company and prevent similar criminal measures.
The Iranian Center for International Criminal Law, an NGO based in The Hague, has submitted a complaint to the Swedish National Contact Point stating that the Swedish company had breached the OECD guidelines by failing to undertake appropriate human rights due diligence, adversely affecting the human rights of EB patients in Iran and failing to remedy its impact. The lawsuit calls on Swedish National Contact Point to hold the company accountable and take action to compensate for the losses Iranian EB patients have suffered and to resume trading with Iran.
Nearly 30 Iranian EB patients, mostly children, have died since Mölnlycke stopped selling its dressings to Iran, saying that for EB survivors, the pain has increased by 70%.
Iranian officials have repeatedly blasted the U.S. for imposing sanctions against the country, stressing that such inhumane sanctions have intensified the sufferings of kids with no access to special medicines for incurable diseases. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
انسان را مطمئن می کند اون ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن می کند.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.